So what did we get into today?
We kicked off talking about potential changes to the sophisticated investor requirements and the impact that might have on the ecosystem.
And we also discussed some of the international comparisons in the UK and the US.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. So we gave a few ideas there. We then unpacked an article headlined, "Local founder says VCs are undermining the Australian startup sector." And given we have VC in our title, we gave our thoughts on what we thought was right from that and what we thought was wrong.
And that led into a bit of a discussion about behavioral patterns and the drama triangle and insights into ourselves a little bit amongst that as well.
Maybe a bit too much.
And then we segued into discuss the recent news of Kiki, the New Zealand funded startup that's launched in New York.
Yeah, wild, wild story there.
Yeah, and then a brief touch on AI and VC and the gut feel we use and how that might be replaced by AI one day.
One of the things we discuss is we believe as a firm that the riches are in the niches, as the US accent would say, and whether that's going to be able to help find niching opportunities. We then expanded that to say actually the short-term riches are in the niches, because as Koala has demonstrated that you can grow and you can get great revenue and you can develop a good brand, but is that actually durable and can you actually make money out of it?
We added some comments from Hamilton Helmer's 7 Powers and how we believe that fits into the advice we give startup.
And I think the overlying theme for the episode was don't get bitter, get better. All right, let's start. Are you sitting there in a jumper, Jack?
Yeah, it's 16 degrees in Adelaide.
16. you definitely get the variance of weather.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so it's 37 degrees on Tuesday next week.
Yeah, wow. That's a bit of change. 21 degree variance.
I came back after a couple of weeks away and there is some grass that I reckon is 3 feet high. It's just the combination of huge amounts of water, huge amounts of humidity. So we ain't got any of that cold, Jack.
Yeah, it's very different climate to Queensland.
How you settling in, Aaron?
Yeah, good. My kids came home yesterday, so we have the full house. And there's a lot of energy. We've got the whole blended family thing happening. So
the full awesome. Brady bunch in suburban Brisbane.
Yeah. Living the dream. It is pretty epic.
Aaron.
Marshall.
Oh, Jack won't know who that is. Let's jump in. We've got a really big week. Thursdays, I look at the newsreel and I wonder, will there be much to talk about next week? And then the universe says, hold my beer. So I think the big thing that's going to affect anyone listening to this podcast in Australia, whether you're a startup or an investor, the government's talking about moving the sophisticated investor requirements from 250,000 of income a year to 450,000 and net assets of 2.5 million to 4.5 million. And I was just having a think of the ecosystem and looking at some of the data. And I think that would then take the percentage of people that can early stage invest from something like 11% of the population down to 0.4%. Is that have I got the right stats there?
Yeah, like huge shift. Shout out to Cheryl Mack, who pulled together some numbers in an article that she had on Startup Daily, where there was an estimate that 70 to 90% of the current investors in this space in venture would actually be ruled out with this change. Like, that's huge. At a time where, yeah, if you look at the global comparables per capita, we're still behind the UK, the US, the big hubs. And so this would, in my view, only be detrimental. And I think it's going to lead to a lot of adverse outcomes. What I didn't know, this current classification has been in place for 22 years. And I actually didn't realize that. So
in 22 years ago, that would have been a nightmare, but we've almost grown into it. And now we're going to send ourselves backwards.
Exactly. But it was a shift. So back then, it was less than 2% of the population met the requirement. Today, it's estimated about 16% meet the current requirement. But it was the way the government kind of said that, is as if that was a problem of itself. And that's the bit
It was like, that's a good point.
Yeah. More people are in our exclusive club now. We better do something about that. But I think also it comes at a time. I mean, there's so much talk about the disparity and this asset class not being accessible to everyone. And if anything, there's been rising sentiment of things like equity crowdfunding and how do we actually bring more people into the asset class and focus on the education side and focus on the regulation of the actual providers, the service providers.
Yeah, the equity crowdfunders will be licking their lips, having watched a few recently. I wouldn't describe it the way that some of the platforms behave as the most sophisticated manner. It's really a marketing machine that tries to create FOMO with people that don't read financial statements.
Yeah, 100%.
It may be a bit harsh. You can at me on LinkedIn. Yeah, so I think with this, it's good that we're all publicly talking about it. We've got to hit the politicians a bit more. So we're obviously going to be pushing our views through a couple of networks. But yeah, if you want to hurt the early stage investment ecosystem, this would be a really great way of going about it.
Yeah, and it is possible to submit a late submission. So even though the government was open for submissions, like formal submissions, apparently they're still accepting some late feedback. So there is an email address that we can share as well. So I think it's definitely something for us to look at. In my view, if you look at UK and US policies around this, in the US, the criteria is an annual income greater than 200,000 or 300 for joint. And the asset test is 1 million, but not counting the family home, the primary residence in that test. And UK is actually similar. UK is £100,000 and the asset test is only £250,000, but again, excluding pension funds and primary residence. So I think that's a smart move. If we look at a lot of wealth tied up in property in Australia and the primary residence, that could be a way of carving out if the government was concerned in that way. But for me personally, I still think investor education would be the smarter approach.
As we know, sophistication and net wealth don't actually go hand in hand. And there are some people that don't even qualify currently that I would class as incredibly sophisticated. And I think it was Alan Jones, the good one, made the point that if these rules come through, a number of people are going to be one downturn away from not being able to run their own company. So we'll see how it plays out. I would like to use the statement that common sense would prevail, but I'm not going to waste oxygen on such a stupid sentiment.
Jack, what's your perspective on this? Like, how are you feeling about it?
Oh, from an investor that doesn't have access to it, it's just a shame because I like the asset class. But I suppose if it's been 16 years, was it, since they've reviewed the change and it hasn't changed, like it probably makes sense that they've got to review it. But my view is they shouldn't up the threshold to have access to this.
I think you're a good case study though, Jack. Your level of sophistication in deal selection would exceed many people I know who qualify as a sophisticated investor.
Yeah, but there's still exceptions to the rule, like currently, but even still, not including myself that has worked in venture, there's still people that I believe would like safely be able to do due diligence on a company in this asset class and that should have access to it. And when you consider they've got access to punting on horses, crypto, there's so many other measures, gambling compared to...
You can literally just go and sign up to CFD sites and all these things into nothing.
But I think like they're trying to protect the retail investors, but our asset class has matured since the early 2000s. It's a totally different world to when technology first came into play.
Yeah, I think so. And I'd probably argue more transparent, or at least more accessible. But the gambling point, I looked up the gambling stats for Australia. So in 2017, Australia had the highest gambling per capita, and like a massive chunk of the population gambles every year. And this is where in a lot of gambling contexts, it's actually regulated how much profit the house makes. So you're guaranteed to lose in long-term play. So it's just, I just find the disparity between all these different rules. And here we are in asset class where we as a group are highly regulated. We have to meet certain criteria. There's, you know, perpetual continued professional development we have to do. And so I find it curious that they're not taking a different approach rather than just an arbitrary metric of income and asset test.
Yeah, hopefully some common sense will prevail. Because what these protections that they're talking about, from what I can understand, they're really nothing to do with our sector whatsoever. Yeah. This is around retail investors falling into effectively scams and schemes, and they've just got to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So we'll see what happens. Now, an article that came out this week on Startup Daily, local founder says VCs are undermining the Australian startup sector. I would put forward that the government's change that we've just spoken about undermines it a little bit more. But Ben Zeal, who's got a startup, wrote an article. And as we have VC in our title, I thought we might just have a little discussion.
Yeah. So look, I don't know this particular founder, and we've all been founders. We know how freaking hard that journey is. And there's nothing like getting a lot of no's and told all the reasons why your baby's essentially ugly.
Yeah.
So I have empathy for the founder side of the table.
And I'm reminded of Jensen from NVIDIA, even after building NVIDIA and with 30 billion, was asked, you know, if you could be 30 again, what would you start? And he said, I wouldn't. it's too hard.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think before we get into looking at the article, having been founders and are founders, okay, you know, all right, we deploy our own capital and the capital of our LPs into companies, but we are trying to build a business.
Yeah.
Tribe Global Ventures is an early stage business that's trying to grow. And I absolutely assure you that we have all of the same challenges in trying to do it. We have to raise capital. We have to find product market fit. We have to get our customers, LPs, interested. We have to, do all of these things. I think one of the comments was ivory towers. Mm. And look, at the big end of town, that probably could be true. But my current ivory tower is my ex laundry shed that I've turned into a makeshift office. If that's the ivory tower, I'm fucked long term.
Yeah, look, and I think one nuance in there is this bucket of VC includes such a variance of fund size, of different managers, GPs with different experience. Some are operators, some are ex-founders, some financial analysts. To categorize the entire VC sector in one way is impossible or inaccurate.
We had a bit of a discussion before this. I'd like to have a conversation as if we would be talking to one of our portfolio and try and have the balance of empathy, but try and call it how we see it. I think there's been a blurring of definitions over a long period of time. People lamenting VCs not putting enough capital into ideas. The majority of VCs, that's not their thesis. Now, for some really big VCs and some they do the seed, but even then, let's say you got angel, the step before angel is the four F's: friends, family, fanatics, and fucking idiots. So you've got to have, it's almost, there's this sequence of, you've got to convince the four F's, which gets some momentum into angel, which then, if done well, moves into VC. But like all Venn diagrams, there's a blurring at those edges. And that's not the founder's fault. There's just a lot of talk about VC. If you take Tribe as an example, we don't seed. We don't invest in just ideas. That's angel. We're part of angel groups, and I've got quite a big angel portfolio, but that's not Tribe.
Yeah, I think throwing the mix in there is private equity as well. And I'm seeing a number of deals hit our inbox, which fit more into private equity. And I think one of my frustrations sitting on various policy advisory panels and councils was always this discussion around, well, venture's not investing in this type of founder that's not aiming for a unicorn. I'm like, well, yes, because that's venture capital. It's looking for venture size returns. It's a different...
It's the power law. It's one out of 10. Like,
exactly.
One makes the winner. Now, we invest in all of the deals hoping that's going to be the winner, but that's just not the way life works out.
Yes. And it was frustrating even having to sometimes educate policymakers and others in the ecosystem around that. And I think that is one thing that's often misunderstood. And listening to what we're hearing out of the US is, it's for VCs over there, it's not even about unicorns anymore, it's decacorns. And the numbers that it needed as a multiple on valuation for returns to be achieved in the venture space. And so I think it is misunderstood sometimes in terms of what we are looking for and the role of venture as distinct from other investors or private equity or even strategic institutional investors or a corporate coming into a cap table.
Yeah,
they're each quite different.
Just to add to your comments, Aaron, like, our definition for a startup is, can this company achieve $100 million revenue in the next 5 years? And that's the scale that we talk about for it to be a fit for venture capital. And if it doesn't, it can still be a great business. It just doesn't fit our mandate in terms of a VC lens.
And there's the is, want, should paradigm that I've spoken about before. It's a world has almost three different lenses. There's the way we think it should be. There's the way that we want it to be. And then there's just the way that it is. Now, should venture capital be that way? It just is the way it is. Do we want it to be different? I'm sure founders do want it to be different. So just being careful of, you can argue whether it should be that way, but that just is the way it is. But that's a good point. Jack, so the article starts off, in an article published elsewhere this week, the country's largest VCs were scornful of the local sector's prospects in 2024. No one is arguing the landscape has become tougher, costs are higher, consumers have tightened their belts. The sector is well aware that we have much to prove in a big jump. Still, the message felt like a dig at the quality of local startups when it's the VCs that should be turning the mirror on themselves. So one of the interesting things there is it's interesting how different people interpret, hey, here's some realism of the situation that we're in. And they turn that into words like dig, scornful. Mm. It's just an interesting mindset. We ourselves have spoken about the challenges. And if we think of the is, want, and should paradigm again, what I'm trying to do is as positively as possible, make sure people are set up to deal with the reality of today. Because if you can deal with the reality of today, then you've got more chance. If you ignore reality and don't understand the environment that we're in, that creates a whole lot of problem.
Yeah, and that's really the intent of this conversation, right? It's to help founders and make sure that, yeah, they don't set themselves up for failure or maybe unrealistic expectations. Yeah, I think if you're a founder and you gave birth to a venture in 2020 to 2021, and the boom time of free-flowing capital and seeing valuations on huge multiples, and that's your baseline, and then you come into this vintage, this era, which is more like 2019 in terms of numbers. And I don't want to say it's more like normal, but these are cycles, so there's patterns here. I think I do understand the sentiment of founders. Like, I do understand the emotional feeling of this. And two conversations with founders this week where they're talking about their valuation, they're getting feedback on their valuation, but when they list their comparables, they're all 21 raises, they're all different growth rates, there's all different factors and metrics that actually fed those valuations.
Yeah. Last week's 20 VC was the HubSpot founder.
Yeah.
And they raised $5 million at a $6 million pre-money. I've raised $1 million at a $4 million pre-money. And I had $1 million of bloody profit, right? Not even revenue. Again, people are a product of their environment, and the environment has been really great, and then now it's not so great. But the article goes on to say that the VCs are making it even harder. Despite raising substantial amounts of capital, they have deployed very little into the local startups. Instead, they're propping up some larger companies. Some really large behemoth VCs raised a lot of capital, and a lot of those, their theses are not seed investments. They are actual venture capital companies that are there to grow companies that already have validation and product market fit. Now, some VCs that do invest in seed, yes, have some dry powder, but when you have a look at LP commitments, they are well down, and therefore they're becoming a lot pickier. And so it's actually more the angel early stage for Fs for seed and that early stage stuff. And that well and truly has dried out significantly just because so many people have gotten burnt in 2020, 2021 and early 2022 with companies that will never see their valuation raise. There, it goes on to say the large Australian VCs have a very narrow view of what looks investable. Yes.
Yeah, we do.
They are VCs. Venture capital has a very narrow view. Venture capital should be used on less than 1%, I'd say, of the companies that are started. Venture capital can make your life hell, right? In the wrong businesses with the wrong aspects, venture capital is not the right thing. And yes, they are very narrow. Now, some venture capital firms that have venture capital in their title, yes, they go earlier, but actually, the whole idea is narrow.
especially in our case, we're niche.
Yeah. They are also skewed to investing in B2B SaaS businesses and seldom take a moment to seek opportunities beyond. Depends on the thesis. Yeah. We are a B2B investor and there are other B2B investors. We're even more niche. We're even more annoying and frustrating because if you're B2B and you don't have the US and the UK on your roadmap and you don't need help with that expansion, we want you in our network. We love you. We want you to come to our drinks or whatever else. But our thesis is that we want to take B2B tech enabled companies, because that's our backgrounds, and do that expansion piece. So we're even worse. And I think one of the key lessons here is that's why it's so important to know who you're talking to. It's so important to, if you keep talking to people, you're not in their thesis, you're going to get pretty pissed off.
Yeah.
And I've been there. I can't remember how many, I must have pitched 20 or 30 investors early on in my insurance tech thing, and they all said no, and it was frustrating.
And we feel this too. Our model is syndication. So we have a database of investors in our network, in our tribe, and each deal we have to go and take it to that network and sell them the investment. And it is frustrating when, like, I remember in the early days, we had a great ag tech hardware business. Yeah. And took it to the network. And no, we don't touch ag. No, we don't touch hardware. And that same frustration as a founder previously was like, but this is a great company. This is exactly in our thesis. We can add value here. We can outperform in terms of the way we can lift the value of this venture. But still, no, we don't invest in that or we don't understand that. And true today, we feel the same, like from our LPs, from our investor base, we feel the same feedback that founders are getting in terms of the cycle of the market and everything else. And it's not fun, but it is what it is.
It goes on to say, in my mind, startups should be very wary of VCs, not the other way around. Yes. Startups should be very wary of VCs because such a small percentage of startups would get value from venture capital.
I would extend that to any investor. They should be wary of any investor coming into their cap table.
Will you truly receive the support promised, or will you fall victim to the VC's own plans? As the article show, they will cut ties very quickly when you fail. I think we've spoken about it before. There's the percentage of VCs that say they add value, and it's what, 80%? Yeah, 90%?
Probably 90.
And then they interviewed founders and said the percentage of VCs that added value to you, and it was what, 20%?
Yeah, I think it was like 25.
And that's why you've got to be really careful on your selection. It's a problem for us because part of our value proposition we genuinely believe is that we do add value and we get really good feedback from our founders. But everyone in our space says they add values. Therefore, there's no value in any marketing messaging.
Yeah, and it's a tough one too, right? Because it's subjective, the adage of the student has to be ready to hear the lesson as well. Yeah. So there's a lot of dynamics in those stats. But yeah, there's no shortage of VCs that claim to add value. I think do your research, get some feedback from other portfolio companies, reach out. It's like anything. You're bringing someone into your business. They're going to be on your cap table. Get to know them.
Some good advice I got early was don't do due diligence with the good ones. Go and do due diligence with the ones that have turned out not good.
Yeah, completely.
How did they behave? What happened when things went wrong? When you ended up in the trenches, were they side by side you or did they make your life hell?
And just on that, so much of the work of good investors I know in those moments where things have gone to shit, that's not public. That's not talked about. That's not shared. And shout out to Elaine Stead. I know what she did helping Shoes of Prey through their wind up and, yeah, above and beyond.
Stayed there when everybody else fucked off. And the other people that fucked off still call themselves founder friendly, but.
Exactly. So it's really hard to make these types of judgments not knowing exactly what the investors are doing in those moments because they're not standing on rooftops shouting about it. They're in the trenches with the founders actually helping.
Yeah,
I think that's a good comment, Aaron. And I liked how you said it's subjective of whether or not VC add value. But I suppose what tribe are seeking to do, like we want to take a concentrated approach and whether or not we add value, that's up to the founder to decide. But we want to spend time with you and actually try and help as opposed to purely taking a portfolio approach. Like we are trying to really select a few concentrated bets and really spend time with the founders.
Yeah, 100%, Jack.
But we will only do that with companies in our thesis. And that thesis is incredibly narrow.
Yeah. And even then, the founders pull us in, right? Like, we're not here being prescriptive. If our value isn't wanted, we're not there ramming it into the company. We're very much driven by what they need.
Yeah. That approach may not be wanted by every founder, and that's okay. But if you're a founder, it's just understanding the approach of the investor that are potentially going to give you money.
Absolutely. It goes on to say, instead of shrouding the market in pessimism, what we should be seeing from VCs is a willingness to back, guide, collaborate with startups. Right now, the job falls on the shoulders of frustrated private investors and board members.
Those two concepts are distinct. You can be pessimistic and still be adding a hell of a value. And I would argue the pessimism is actually the is of the current climate.
I got pulled up by a investor. You were there, Aaron.
Yeah.
He said, I get all of this, but what we need to do is pump up. And I think you need both. You need both ends of the spectrum. We need to have energy and passion and irrational exuberance, right? That's what builds businesses. The founders that we see constantly are the ones that are able to just, it's that meme that I posted. You see that meme where I was like the Paul Rudd in the van with the guy, and Paul says, oh, how's your girlfriend? He says, oh, no, she left me. And my mum died and my dad got deported, but I got this van. Paul and Rudd's characters, yeah, got the van. Like, that's maybe it's not the way it should be. That's the way it is, right? Founders that can somehow go problem, but at least I've got this.
Yeah.
At least I can see the good, and that takes accountability and responsibility, which we'll get to a little bit later. But it's all too easy to slip into that. We're human. I do it all the time. I call it the trough of fuckery, where you just get dragged down. And you just want to have a good cry and a good give up, but actually resilience and the ability to shake off this stuff. Now, is some of the stuff too pessimistic? I don't know. But if it's too pessimistic, stop bloody reading it.
That irrational exuberance, I think you have to have awareness of reality. But then how does Tony Robbins describe it? So the red car effect, where founders will see the data point that they want to see. And I'm reminded of Dumb and Dumber, where he's got the crush on the girl and he said, do I stand a chance? And she's one in a million. There's still a chance. That's the founder. They see the one data point in all the noise that keeps them going because they believe it. And I think your point about if you're overly pessimistic, the founding life will be bloody hard for you.
And that's why sometimes in life you need a consultant. Sometimes in life you need an insultant. And part of certainly my portfolio support role sometimes is that of the insultant, to grab them by the ear sometimes and say, come on, pull it out. But at the same time, I reserve my right to say, you know what? Here's the reality of today's situation. Here's the difficulties that are being faced by a lot of companies. And what we've got to do now is say, okay, in light of that, what do we want? And then based on what do we want, as long as it's got some reasonable connection, what should we be doing? And that's where strategy and all of that comes through. And then we're all working our backsides off and spending time trying to get their attention. As we've discussed early, are you actually a VC company, or are you more an angel, or are you more PE, or are you none of those? Should you be building an organic business that can grow? We are working to work of their backsides off, our backsides off, trying to get their attention. But the truth is, business goes on without them, and it's nothing to be scoffed at. Totally.
Yeah. 100%.
If you can build a business without investment, without all of the rubbish that comes with it, without wankers like me trying to say, what about this? What about that? Let's do this. And you end up with all of your equity and then you get to sell it. Not only is that not scoffed at, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah. Celebrate that. Go for that. Far out. Like, far out.
We empathize with the situation, and the universe of startups is to frustrate you as much as possible. And that's only a door for a very small group of people that can get these product market fit right, timing right, but then also resilience and mindset and all of that stuff right. And it's tough. Just be careful curating what happens in your mind, because compounding interest of thought is a real thing.
And I think maybe a final comment from me is, like, we're the first to admit that venture is not the perfect system. Like, there are I'm sure there are massive opportunities that we're missing and efficiencies and all these things. And there's probably good deals that don't get through and there's all sorts of biases and everything else. And so for those that think it could be done better, like typical entrepreneurial energy, go have a crack.
Out of venture firm.
Go have a crack.
Am I making things up? Or was it only 2 weeks ago people were having a dig at Blackbird for writing too many checks?
Yeah,
that's true.
Weren't we talking about that? And then like they did a review and it was the same amount of investments last year as the previous year.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. You're right, Jack.
It's just too hard to fit in.
Yeah. We're founders ourselves. I hope this part is taken in the spirit that it's intended. And I hope that for other founders that are a bit in that trough and lamenting and oh, woe is me and all that shit that the brain does. I've written about it and spoken about it before. I've implemented a quarterly therapy session where somewhere between 4 and 6 hours, I just go and you go and bare your soul. There's a few non-traditional parts of it that we don't need to get into, but we'll just smile our way through it. But in the last couple of sessions, what they've really got me understanding, and I think it's relevant here, is a lot of people have heard the drama triangle. Mm. Right? And the drama triangle is victim, rescuer, persecutor, or rescuer is often savior. And for me, what that process has really done is highlight my propensity sometimes to be on the victim side, poor me, feeling powerless, oh, woe is me, the world's against me. I also have some fairly strong savior complex problems. And why that is, we don't need to get into, but that's where you want to try and run in and save other people and try and help them. And actually, victims need to move to creators, right? The opposite of the triangle is, no, not woe is me. I'm not a victim. I'm a survivor and I'm going to get through it. And this situation that's occurring is actually a lesson for me because victim mentality, my view of it is it's almost like a defense mechanism and it's something that the brain does to us. And when I'm in that mode, it actually feels quite good because it gives an alibi for personal fuck-ups and failures. It generates sympathy. There's almost like a social currency to it. It attracts. And some of my most negative traits get hidden and they look like virtues when you're in that sympathetic kind of mode. Whereas if you flick it and catch yourself, and that's what these sessions have been helping me do, you just go, oh, hang on a minute. Get some perspective. Got to move more into creator and saviors can move more into coaches, right? Only get involved when asked, and when asked not to save, it's to actually just support and provide some ideas and provide a bit of a mirror and not reinforce the victim stuff. And for someone like me who loves portfolio support, and what is portfolio support? Portfolio support is helping others. In hindsight, a lot of it is when founders have gotten downtrodden into that negative mindset, have moved into victim mentality. And what you've got to do is you've got to take responsibility and you've got to get out of it. And don't spend time writing this stuff. Write what you've learned from it. Write what you're going to do different. Trick yourself. Trick your brain.
Yeah, there's so much in this topic. We could make a dedicated podcast episode just on this. This is essentially also what we do at one of the offsites. In a roundabout way, I tend to go into that rescuer category and there's all sorts of reasons from my childhood and all sorts of issues I won't bore anyone with, but that independence of a childhood led to me learning a pattern of behavior that then manifested in this way where, to your point about the comfort, like we identify these patterns from our childhood and we can live in those patterns and we do get social reinforcement of them. Like when we write about victimhood, guess what happens? People reach out. That you get the empathy, you get the sympathy, you get that currency. And without consciously realizing it, it becomes a comfortable place. And same for me with that rescuer thing. So hence why I shifted into coaching. And I can't say that was conscious at the time. It definitely helped me to realize my behaviors and how, okay, I need to switch this and I'm not the solution to everything. And I can be useful when called upon, but outside of that, I need to stay in my wheelhouse. And it's often hard for us to identify.
Oh, when you're in the pain, like for me, that's why doing the quarterly things. I don't like New Year's resolutions, but 2024 was a bit like, nah, you're on the top side of this triangle. Mm. It's creator and challenger.
A good book for me in this topic was Hardwiring Happiness. And looking at this, like neuroplasticity and the patented neural pathways that we build through repeated behavior, and how do you actually intercept those and have a practice to build new ones so that you shift from in the triangle. That was a great first read to get into this space for me.
We'll leave that there. I hope it's taken in the spirit that it's that's intended. We love founders. We want to be there to support, but in the spirit of moving from rescuers and persecutors more into challengers and coaches, this is what we think is important, or maybe not, each to their own. If you can give me, if you can find me a successful founder that has built something really great from a position of victim mentality, please write in and I will eat my hat.
Yeah, I think it's more likely the debate will be that they're not. But, and I think, what was it, 2 weeks ago, Don, I fell in a bit of a 24-hour victimhood triangle.
A V-hole.
Around tribe and everything else. And, the current investment cycle. And it was, just chatting through it with you and having a co-founder that you can have those conversations with and just go, and then 24 hours, okay, all good.
Yeah. I think I said, shut your fucking face and pull your head in.
Which is usually what I need. It's effective. But we all have those moments. Like, I consider myself default incredibly optimistic and positive, but you can have those moments.
Now, segueing to another thing, one of the things that can be incredibly frustrating is when founders see big money going to things that on the surface to them at least look like they are in no way even comparable to the thing that I'm building. And we've seen this Kiki story in the last 24 hours, which is just wild. Blackbird invested in August 23. So what's that, 4 months ago, in a platform so you can effectively breach your lease terms, which all leases, as a landlord say, no subletting.
Subletting, yeah.
But you can breach your lease terms by using a platform where a stranger can come into your home and greater than zero risk of fucking trashing the place. And out of nowhere, it seems that they've now pivoted into a girls' club.
Like a girls' club. I'm just taking a moment.
I don't know where to go with this now.
I'm taking a moment to laugh at the way you just pitched Kiki. But look, at the original thesis, yes, okay, so it breached leases and lots of challenge with it. But I can see as a disruptive tech.
Come on, Aaron, try and salvage our brand. Come on, keep going.
As a disruptive tech doing something in a housing crisis, I can see the I can see the goal and the aspiration. But, 4 months post-investment, complete left field pivot.
And the random, so if you look at how it's all played out, is they shut down Sydney to go to the New York because it was a big environment. And then they've hired their first, it's a woman, by the way, not girl. I have two girls, a five-month-old and a four-year-old, who will then transition into being women at some point. And they hired their first woman who then has highlighted to them that it's hard to make friends or something. And then via Instagram, they've announced that they're stopping subletting, the thing that they raised $6 million for, and they're going to create a girls' club. I have some empathy when people like Ben, who are probably building something they can believe can really help and change the world or whatever else, when this kind of thing happens, it just seems like, why the fuck is it so easy for everyone else?
Yeah. Look, safe spaces for women, absolutely important and needed. But the video on TikTok, which got shared around, it was cringeworthy. I've just discovered that girls have a problem. And just
it's not safe. What we understand is safe spaces and the challenges
exactly.
Evolution as men trying to become more aware of the things that we weren't aware of.
Yeah.
This is like 12-year-old. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem to.
No. And it's amazing how quickly it's blown up, but also not amazing given how it was described and brought out. But Jack, you were saying that they actually have had a lot of signups to the new.
Yeah. So when you sent through the link, Don, I just had a look on the Instagram. They were up to 400 like people on the wait list. So I don't know.
We're talking about a $6 million raise at some pre-money. It's got to end up being hundreds of millions. If I. Yeah, okay, 400. I'd love 400 LPs. that would be a big thing. But is it apples for apples, do we think? What's the monetization path here for...
I don't think they've released that like that. So we don't actually know. And yeah, we're assuming from a TikTok, which could have just been the marketing stunt. Like inside, there could have been so many data points why subletting is hard right now. So like, I think we're assuming so much from one TikTok that's been blown up from them. And we're assuming that Blackbird has no idea about the pivot, or like they're pivoting just on a click of the finger. Yeah, yeah. But there has to be more data points to do this.
There should be. I think that's the thing.
Jack, I've been around a lot longer than you and I've seen some real dumb shit. But yeah. I like that you've got this exuberance.
No, but I love that thought, Jack, that based on what you read and heard and what he said, you're like, yeah, there's got to be more to this than just he's just had this epiphany. There's got to be some data driving this decision. And look, I hope so. But even 400 signups on what's New York City, 8.5 million people?
Yeah, but that's like, 400 signups in an hour.
They
got 30,000 followers. The founder's a beast marketer by the looks of it. Like he's in front of the camera. He's pumping content every minute. He's pumping stuff out. Like he moves fast. So I think you put 6 months behind that, see where they can pivot and find some a fit in the market, I think would be a surprise.
Yeah.
True. But then there's just some real, it's not even weird. I think it's like objectively bad. Like the way he's like, oh, we went for a coffee with her. She was too serious. So we then invited her for drinks. It's just like in this.
I miss that part.
Yeah.
Like I miss that part. You can apply her with alcohol and then work out. Like it's.
Yeah, there's some red flags there.
What I did like in the article, Don, that the blog post that was written about Kiki was talking about Airbnb and Andreessen Horowitz. So when they had that time, like it was a perfect reminder when you've got a young founder who's got a really fast growing startup, always plug yourself with really good advisors that are going to be with you when things go wrong. So this hasn't been received well. I hope that this founder has some people on his side that are helping him work through this.
Yeah, very good point.
Good point, Jack.
Very good point.
Because you can't expect a founder to get everything right. There's going to be so many fuck-ups, and this founder's quite young. So I just hope he's got people around him that are like, hey, mate, let's work through this. This is how you should probably go about this.
And you made the point yesterday that Blackbird has a bit of a core competency of putting money into things that pivot.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's just my view. Like they've got a lot of dry powder. My view, it's patient capital. We can't really afford to do that. But you look at, I think from a podcast where Nick Crocker said, when Tim Doyle first pitched Eucalyptus to where Eucalyptus now, it's a totally different company. So to me, it's like really, they're finding these really generational founders and they back them to have the ability to continuously pivot to find the model that works. And that could be totally wrong. Just my view from the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think, yeah. There's just a bit like that other article. There's just, this has multiple factors that make this just a bit of a what the fuck. And then with a lot of the negativity that's been thrown at Blackbird, I just want to make the nuance. This whole blow up isn't Blackbird. This is the risk even we have. We've got to back founders that have this irrational exuberance and energy and try and put some rails for them to run on so they become a guided missile rather than an unguided missile. And so I genuinely believe Blackbird backed something and then now I would say, based on my pattern recognition and having been in not dissimilar situations in the past, we've just got an unguided missile here that's just shooting off. If Blackbird became so risk adverse that they couldn't take punts on this potentially being an outcome, that's bad for the ecosystem.
And I actually think we see the opposite far too often. So like we back a founder and we believe that X is going to happen. If we're continuously not meeting those forecasts, the founder doesn't want to make the hard decision and pivot. I can think so many times, like you're trying to give advice strategy. They don't want to pivot because they continuously believe their strategy is the right one. But the data points are smack in front of you. And clearly what you believe isn't true.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why that reporting framework and whatever else is so important. But no, you're right, Jack. And keep in mind that at best we have some influence. We don't have control.
And yeah, man in the arena, we're in the cheap seats as observers of this one. We're not the founder, we're not in the tent. Yeah,
that's why we started this podcast to be in the cheap seats, so we could behave badly and then get probably really defensive when this happens to us and then cry.
That's a great name for a podcast. podcast. The cheap seats. You just comment on everyone else's stuff.
I have a feeling that ours would actually be the cheapest seats.
You're assuming we even get seats. It's going to be sitting on the floor.
Yeah, we only make comment if it's third hand from other people.
From unreliable sources.
But yeah, so again, nuance. I find Kiki and what happened at very least intriguing, at the other end batshit crazy, but separate that I think it would be absolutely unreasonable to put blame on Blackbird or try and say that this is a Blackbird fuck-up. Blackbird has invested in a company. They have pivoted. I reserve my right to make commentary about how they've gone about it, but I'm not having a crack at Blackbird. Tribe Global Ventures invests in and supports Australian and New Zealand B2B-focused companies that are ready to expand into the US and or the UK. In addition to investing in companies, we run founder and investor multi-day scale-up offsites where founders and investors come together to scale their companies, as well as running US and UK market entry missions designed to help you understand these international markets and hit the ground running to open operations. Here's what founders and investors have to say.
It was a great sort of temperature check of where the business is at, and that's always helpful because half the time you don't know if what you're doing is what you should be doing.
Getting to spend time with founders in a space that takes you out of the day-to-day, takes you out of the business of working in a big city, and I think this location absolutely nails that.
Being together with others, sharing your stories and hearing how similar in some ways they are to everybody else.
And how great has that been?
Yeah, it's really refreshing. Yeah.
I think this weekend's been a really powerful way to just get really clear on what tools work and how could I implement them quickly and effectively into the business.
And the other thing is just the empathy that all these other founders show for one another. I feel like the founder journey, you hear it all the time, can be quite lonely, but I feel like you hear these anecdotes here over the weekend. I think that just helps to bring that to life.
As an investor wanting to make a difference to my portfolio, like I believe that if I can help my portfolio succeed, that's going to increase the enterprise value of those companies. It's going to make them more likely to be able to get to the next milestone. And so there are lots of, you know, really practical tools that I can now use when I'm having a conversation with the startups that I'm invested in to just go, hey, have you thought about this in that way? And so, yeah, I think there's, you know, great opportunity for investors to come along to this, and also gives an investor a great opportunity to meet cool startups.
You can learn from the ones that are a little bit ahead of you.
Knowing that everyone has problems at every stage of the business, it kind of frees you up to de-stress about the problems that you're facing today. And you go, okay, this is normal. I'm not the only one.
We run offsites in February, May, August, and November of each year, and go to the US in March and the UK in June. Check out our events page at tribeglobal.vc to find out more.
This is a good segue to AI making our jobs redundant, because what we're talking about here is pattern recognition. We have a lot of gut feel. Jack, I know every day it's like a lesson in Don and Aaron's past experiences coming to play in predicting what others are doing and pattern recognition of founders doing XYZ. But yeah, there is an article in Capital Brief this week about AI in VC overcoming the gut feel that we talk about and that we definitely have. I'm really conscious of it, is my gut feel. I would even say my biases. And, you know, a lot of the work we did early in Tribe around documenting our investment criteria. Don, you did some great stuff pulling together a traffic light system and scorecards and all sorts of systems and tools that we use.
It doesn't have lots of colors. What's the point?
I remember one of my mentors talking about gut feel and how you actually have to train it but have some sort of system, like some sort of scorecard to then measure and know if it's actually accurate or not. And it is an opportunity in AI to challenge gut feel, because the other challenge of gut feel in VC is we're looking to invest in new things that haven't been done before. And so you could easily argue, how does gut feel play a role in that? But for us, it's gut feel around the founder, the pattern recognition of behaviors, the structures, the systems, those sort of things that play out.
Yeah, it seems like it's gut feel around the soft skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is humanistic, right? The fact it's gut feel to me resonates.
And almost inevitably wrong.
Yeah.
Because our gut feel gets formed in a fake environment the environment you actually need is when things are turning to shit. That's when you actually know.
Yeah, it's the only time you can actually judge character.
That's when your gut feel is probably really...
Yeah, and a lot of gut feel is driven by the hippocampus, and depending on what sort of trauma responses we have that we're not even aware of, and we have our own patterns playing out in there.
Oh, totally. I am very much of the view now. We are just all walking trauma responses. That's just...
We are just chemical reactions on legs. The software from age 7 just keeps replaying.
Yeah, exactly. Children stuck in an adult's body, at least in this situation. And for me, like even yesterday, there was a little interaction that came back with a deal, and my gut feel on the email was, I don't like that. But then I had to pause and I said, hold on. A, why don't you like it? And normally when you get a negative reaction to something, at least in my case, it's a reflection of yourself. And then it's, don't forget what we're trying to do here. We're trying to back people to do X, Y, and Z, and therefore it takes all shapes and sizes. And so it's this constant, it's not easy. And this is related to the previous article, is one should. We take our money and LP's money. We have these obligations. We have these requirements. There is this constraint set that is on top of us. And then if we're on a board, we've got Corporations Act and fiduciary duties to deal with. And that can sometimes be in conflict, and we've spoken about it before. AI can come in and help with some of that stuff, but I still think it's going to be augmenting us.
Yeah. Yeah, so far it seems process improvement value. It was interesting. I saw an interview with Sam Altman where he was talking about, he was comparing the current state of AI to Isaac Newton. And he said where AI is at the moment is it's like Isaac Newton sitting down reading all of the math journals from around the world and having that base knowledge, and it could do deductive reasoning. What Isaac Newton had to do to come up with his theorems was actually create a new hypothesis, like actually create a new concept to be tested, and AI is not at that point yet.
Yeah.
And he was saying that'll be the transitionary moment. So for us right now, yeah, it's really interesting as we keep having these chats internally about how do we use AI in what we do. It tends to fall back to process improvement right now.
I really want to find how AI can help us with the niches. And if you think of Kiki, that's a hell of a niche, as much as I make fun of it. That really plays into some of the things we talk about quite often, is that the riches are in the niches, or in the US slang, the riches are in the niches. And even for Ben's article that we discussed earlier, I do wonder often when I find a founder that's struggling to get that momentum with investors and get that, and investors and customers, is are they niche enough? And so I'm hoping that AI can not only help deal with gut feel, but success leaves clues. And if you have a look at any really successful company, the pattern that we constantly see is the riches are in the niches, and they start with something really, really tight. I will say, though, with the work that we've started to do with Hamilton Helmer's Seven Powers, I think that the saying should actually be changed to the short-term riches are in the niches, but actually durability comes from developing a long-term power. And it came to mind because Koala Mattresses, there was a news article, an Aussie company. That's a hell of a niche, right? Selling mattresses online. I think they've grown to over $100 million of revenue, but they're still losing a huge amount. Growth has slowed to only 2%. They've got a $48 million convertible note due in July. And so, yes, they found a niche and they found some revenue riches, but they don't seem to have been able to convert it into power because of competition and all of those aspects. Their brand they've developed is really strong, but that doesn't seem to have gotten them pricing power, given so many competitors have popped up. And the only power I can really see that they could develop from this point is like scale economies of being able to develop the mattresses and sell them and distribute them cheaper to anyone else. But their P&L says that they haven't been able to do that either.
Yeah. It's like early niching. It's like we say about a few things, required but not sufficient. But that time aspect, and Jack, really keen to hear your thoughts around this one as it relates back to the seven powers and broader strategy as well.
Yeah, I suppose... I gave this some thought, but the way I look at it, like the riches are in the niches, that's a strategy. And Adrian spoke about this on the podcast, like whether you go horizontally or vertically, like they're just two different strategies. Your job is to pick one. Time and time again, we see that picking one sector and going really deep is the easiest strategy to execute, especially while you're a lean startup with limited funds. That's not to say being a horizontal strategy can't win. It just needs a hell of a lot more money to execute. But when I think of that, like this relates to like validating the business, and it goes back to, can you find product market fit? And that's why we think that's an easier strategy. But finding product market fit isn't like it's required, but it's not sufficient, and it doesn't ensure success over the long term. And Koala is a perfect example because they were an early mover in this space. First, one of the first to offer the direct to consumer mattresses, found product market fit in the high density cities where it's really hard to get mattresses into the apartment buildings. But that doesn't ensure long-term success, right? Like their margins were squeezed because they didn't have a structural competitive advantage. So yeah, that's the two different views there. And when we look at validating a business, that's finding product market fit. But then when you look at the durability of a business, that's actually whether or not they can have or they can maintain pricing power. And that's how I look at it. And they're two different steps.
Mm. Yeah, I like that, Jack. That makes a lot of sense.
And what we find often when we're working with either potential companies or portfolio is that there's this fear that sector or market or ideal client type isn't big enough. Now, if that's the case, that's a whole problem in itself. But often what we find is it's actually easier to start it locally and then grow internationally with that exact sector than it is to then go broader into totally different markets. Because totally markets require different messages, different processes, different product delivery. It's actually, we sometimes find far easier to go, you know what, I'm going to own this particular space for this particular customer, and I'm going to take all of those testimonials, and then I'll go to New Zealand, and I'll go to the US, and I'll go to UK, and then I'll go and I'll just keep owning it. We're really good at this for this kind of market than it is to try and go the horizontal route.
Yeah, Adrian's comments, like, were easier to own one sector globally than trying to take a horizontal approach. And that's from his own experience from scaling TechOne.
Yeah, and knowing that niche that you can be the natural owner of. For me, it comes down to speed. It gives you speed to grow. And then when you can find those other, whether it's a global market that you shift into, and we know as well how hard that can be. Like there is an assumption that the US market will be just like the Australian market and actually doesn't require that shift. You have to have the understanding of what that is like, because sometimes there is a significant shift in a new global market. It's not just the same niche with the same message, with the same everything else.
And something we've been chatting internally with a portfolio, like if you do niche down, is the TAM big enough? But it's really just trying to get across that a TAM isn't fixed and it grows. And using Koala as an example, they started out selling mattresses. They've expanded. Since they reached scale, they've expanded their product line, but they earned the right to exist for that one product. And now they sell lounges.
Amazon did books. Facebook started as one type of social media network for one type of university in one region. And then owned the shit out of that and then went broad. Google started with a very simple search bar that didn't have all of the other stuff of their competitors. Success leaves clues. Now, the entrepreneurial brain, though, has difficulty with that. We could solve this problem and this problem. And to be perfectly clear, in the early stage, it's not that dysfunctional because you're still trying to learn who that ideal client profile is. But once you find it, once you smell it, the power of saying no, so you can then focus. There's an article that is going to come out. My broad view is that there's three buckets of companies. This is a gross oversimplification, but there are like the early rocket ships. There's just a set of ingredients, product market fit. Within a couple of years, they just go strong. And then there's the early failures. Like it just doesn't work. But the most painful is the middle crew, the limp-alongs, where they're able to raise capital and they just keep slogging it out year after year. And these founders are hardworking, not idiots, but the market conditions just don't deliver them success. And the problem is a lot of those limp-alongs partly because they started too wide, they kept too wide, and then they either run out of runway or they learn that focus is the key, but then they've let other competitors who were focused come and own it. And before you know it, they're in a red ocean that's highly competitive, margin sensitive. And if they had started focused and, to your words, Jack, earned the right to own it and reinvested those cash flows, that's how they then get critical mass, like a rocket trying to get enough velocity to get out of the atmosphere. And so it's almost like by the time they've learnt that, it's too late. And now at best, we've got a cottage business.
Yep.
And it's hard. It's hard watching smart people that, let's face it, when you invest in a company, you spend time with them, you become fond of each other. Sorry.
Yep.
I become fond of them. They generally don't become fond of me. Whilst, as we've seen from the early part of this podcast, we feel our role is not always just trying to placate and play nice and smiling. We sometimes need to have difficult conversations to help reframe a mindset. You still have a fondness and a love for the people that you've put your own time, money and effort into. And it's difficult watching them struggle.
And it's not for their lack of conviction or effort or energy or they've got it. They are 100% in.
Some founders just have a series of life experiences and decisions and closing door moments that lead them to interesting ideas in shitty business models. Some founders that aren't any cleverer, aren't any smarter, aren't any whatever else, just have a series of events that lead them to this panacea.
I think one of the things I've seen play out is when you get early great indicators, early traction, you stop the experimentation and you double down on what's working, but then you find out, wow, this is actually a really short runway, that the TAM isn't quite what I thought, or it becomes competitive early. And so in the very early days, I think early experimentation is really important. And even when you start getting positive indicators on one, actually still running some other experiments because there's an opportunity cost of not experimenting, which could be a bigger opportunity. And I don't think enough founders spend time experimenting very early to understand what they're leaving on the table by not pursuing other opportunities or other markets or positionings. Yeah, I think it's tough when you're in the painting. It's bloody hard to know what data to trust and follow and what advice to follow.
We've had a situation this week that looks like luck will have played more than intelligence on our behalf, but it's luck favors the prepared and fortune favors the brave. It's these two things that are constantly, and sometimes timing you just don't get right. You're unlucky. Sometimes timing you do get right. A lot of luck is because people were prepared and working at it. And my whole life, as I sit in the moment, is a combination of just being at the right place at the right time. But I didn't sit on my ass. I actually was out there pushing hard, and then luck came down. Now, is that replicatable? Who knows? But success leaves clues, so I'm going to keep trying to do it.
I think the compounding interest of behavior, right? Like it may not be showing dividends while you're in the trough of fuckery. You know, that just continue perpetual showing up, putting the energy in, doing it. I hope it does pay dividends eventually. And when luck comes, you are in that, you're prepared for it.
Jack, I remember once on Zoom, because we would constantly be on Zoom, and when you're sharing your screen, it shows you all the tabs. And there was a point where you just pointed out, like, why do you always have 40 property tabs open for properties?
I mean, 40.
Underplaying it.
More like 80.
And that was just one screen of one browser. Yep, you got to be in it. You got to be doing the things.
If there is changes to the sophisticated investor that causes some challenge, if founders aren't getting the traction that they want, if you're not happy with something an investor's doing or whatever else, the theme that I think lives ever strong is don't get bitter, get better. Yeah. And for us, whatever the world's going to come at us, it depends on how much we're going to sit on which side of that drama triangle. And it's human nature, and it's going to default some negative behaviors. Let it flow over, but don't get bitter, get better.
Love it. But you know what? I feel like Don't Get Bitter, Get Better is like an ad for a beer that's competing against VB.
Don't Get Bitter, get better. 4X. Yeah.
Well, where I first heard it was The 12th Man, where Richie Beno has a dream and Kerry Packer's ghost.
Yes.
Richie's getting boned, if you recall. And Kerry's like, Richie, pull your head in. Don't get bitter, get better. And he wakes up and they start exercising it. But I love it. Don't get bitter, get better. 4X.
How good.
If 4X want to come on as a sponsor, just let us know. We're very open to it. Yeah.
And Jack, you're going to have four seasons in 1 week. So you're going from 16 degrees to 37. So what are you going to use with that? What are you going to do with that heat?
I'll be at the beach this weekend. It should be warming up from tomorrow. So back to the beach.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Nice. Nice, nice, nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to a weekend focused on the kids. So we'll be doing a bit of Brisbane stuff and getting them ready for school because they go back on Monday.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Kids focus weekend. What about you, Don?
In the yard. It's gotten away from me being away, so I'm going to be trying to do that. I've got my sister's wedding in October. It's just dawned on me how much stuff I've agreed to do, and there's not actually a lot of time to do it. So I'm going to be just getting cracking on that.
I have to organise a working bee.
She lives in Perth, so the problem is it's the most classic stitch-up ever.
Don, how excited are you to get on the mower? And which one are you choosing?
Jack, it'll be a multi-layered affair. It has gotten so long in some areas, it'll actually be the tractor with the mulcher, and then we'll move down to the yellow mower. And in the areas where the wedding is going to be happening, then we'll have the finishing.
I love it. Libby thinks you're doing chores this weekend. You're throwing the AirPods in, having a great time.
Libby could be listening, Jack.
There is zero chance of that.
Oh, Maren said to me this morning, I really wish I had time to listen to your podcast. I'm like, no, please don't.
No, you got blended family to now. Yeah, I'm going to be my true wanker self, Jack. I'll be flipping between them.
I think we need a photo for next week on the mower.
Yeah, this is therapy might be helping with a range of things, but not this. All right, good.
Good stuff, boys.
All right, we'll catch you on the flippy.
See you then.
All right.
See ya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you're a sophisticated investor under Australian law, we'd welcome you to sign up to our investor syndicate, where we'll notify you of investment opportunities as they come up. If you're a B2B founder and think Tribe would be a fit for you, go to Get Capital page of our website. And whether you're a founder or an investor, if you're looking to take your early stage investing or company to the next level in 2024, consider joining one of our offsites or US and UK market entry missions occurring in February, March, May, June, August, and November.